the great scientist referred to God as the gaseous vertebrate. And there is this strange idea of literalism about God. If God is real, he will manifest in history. There's a definite beginning and end of things, so we have time spread out, not, as Eliade said, the eternal return. That's the old religions, the animistic religions. It's always the eternal return. When you get to the Neolithic times and the planting cultures, starting with Zoroastrianism, you have linear time, and these are called the eschatological religions because they depict a beginning. God created the world. We all know that. And I have a poem about that in which I say, well, what did he do with all the tools and stuff? God created the world, and there's going to be a big ending, a really great finale. When the world ends, it's going to be a big deal. Of course, the end is near. We're going to explore that in a minute. Eschaton in Greek means the end of days. So Campbell said, if you want to find out the religion of a place, look for the tallest buildings. And that always appealed to me because Sun Myung Moon owned the Empire State Building for a while. And of course, this is beautiful Chartres Cathedral. Materialism, I'll have to speak with Spengler's accent, is a type of idealism, scientific, irreligious, a fossil representative of the older religions of the heart. Very influential on Joseph Campbell, Decline of the West. So, the metaphysical materialist. There are a few of them around and about. It's kind of an oxymoron. The torments of hell are all depicted as taking place to somebody's physical body. You're going to be roasted, you're going to be flayed, you're going to be thrown in these ovens time and time again because you're such a bad person. And there is a bodily resurrection on the last day of judgment, a bodily resurrection. There are still religions that are very serious about the fact, and they won't cremate their members because there's going to be a bodily resurrection. It's a big deal. It's a tough deal, but they're going to do it. And the 72 virgins awaiting the shaheed, the guy who commits murder on infidels and so on. And Jonathan Edwards was famous for his sermons on sinners in the hands of an angry God. He used to terrify those congregations in New England and roundabouts on what God would do to them. Anybody ever read Jonathan Edwards' sermons? They're really scary. I just almost became religious on the spot. Pascal, on effective religion, it must be contrary to nature, to common sense, and to pleasure.
Whimsical French.
Now, Daisetsu Suzuki, sometimes called the Buddha of the North, wrote on Western religion and Eastern religion, and he came to the Aranos conferences, the Balingan conferences, that Jung attended and met Jung and Campbell. He was a little man. He was asked one of those conferences what he thought about Western religion, and he got a very thoughtful look on his face, and he rubbed his sides, and he said, now, let me see. Man against nature, nature against man. Man against God, God against man. Nature against God, God against nature. Very funny religion. Gandhi, asked what he thought of Western civilization, said, I think it would be a very good idea. The hotter I grow, the more ardent do my prayers become. Despite his advanced views, Luther advocated burning heretics and executing revolting peasants. Martin, the peasants are revolting. I'll say they are. Martin Luther and John Calvin both began Protestantism by identification with the oppressor. They burned heretics. After all, what self-respecting religion would fail to burn heretics? The very idea.
Yeah.
Now, St. Teresa, I love her eyes in this painting. And of course, here is the St. Peter's. Anyone who has had a true vision from God will detect a false one immediately. It is the most impossible of all impossibilities that this can be the work of the imagination. Unless I have the incorruptible conviction this is the solution, I do nothing. Not even if the whole party tried to drive me to action, I will not act. I will wait, no matter what happens. But if the voice speaks, then I know the time has come to act. The same author says, any violence which does not spring from a firm spiritual base will be wavering and uncertain. It lacks the stability which can only rest in a fanatical outlook. There you go.
Yeah.
He listened to the voice, and he had some kind of a spiritual thing that he was doing. Of course, his propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, was very, very influenced by the brother-in-law of Freud, who was the psychologist who was the master of propaganda. Blocking on his name right
oh,
now.
Oh, yes. He just...
Bernays, Edward Bernays.
Bernays. Who
Someone said that. Yeah.
He invented pretty much the whole advertising system
he
that
says you
we
have to
now
treat,
are afflicted by.
You have to treat people pretty much as children, said he. So
he
here's
brilliant. He came to the United States and talked to the big companies after.
So now we make a little neurological excursion, if we may, into what's going on in the brains of these no-fun dementalists. Okay. 10 trillion, with glia, brain cells, makes us the most complicated creature in the known universe. The glial cells, by the way, are 10 times as frequent as the neurons, and they are regarded as a kind of scaffolding that holds the neurons up, except now we know that they have a much, much more important role to play in the brain. God won't go away because God is nestled among our synapses. And when I set out to write this book, I had to read all these books, the God Gene, what is that called, weird theology?
Neurotheology. Yeah, that was
the God part of the brain and why we believe what we believe. I mean, there are a ton of books out there that show us that human beings are wired to believe in something. Neurotheology. This is your brain on God. Okay. So up here in the parietal lobe, a person can feel at one with the universe. Response to religious words is located here in the right-hand, it's called the homologous site of Wernicke's area. Sacred images, the lower temporal lobe is involved in the process by which images such as candles or crosses facilitate prayer and meditation. And even more than that, it doesn't mention it here, but there is the rhinencephalon, the part of us that sniffs the odor of sanctity. And if you've grown up in a Catholic church smelling the incense, boy, that has a powerful effect on you. Religious emotions, the middle temporal lobe is linked to emotion. Attention, linked to concentration, the frontal lobe lights up red at the top in scans during meditation. And the right lateral view of the brain. We're going to talk about how this right hemisphere that we're looking at here, unfortunately, which is probably the main religious hemisphere, also tends to be pessimistic. The left hemisphere is much more optimistic. Everybody slanders the left hemisphere.
Do you have the mapping of the male brain?
Oh, that's a wonderful slide.
Yes, I do have it in my office.
There's a good one for it's the dog brain is there, too.
Yeah, sex is the largest. Okay.
Football, yes.
So how many people here have read Julian
we
James'
should have included those.
Bicameral Mind book, The Theory of the Bicameral Mind? It's really quite an interesting thing. James was a Princeton professor of psychology, I think, not of religion, and the origins of consciousness in the separation of the bicameral mind, and the fact that in the right hemisphere, the left hemisphere is the more conscious, linguistic, discursive brain in most people, and the right one is more unconscious and emotional. The recognition of facial expressions, maps, religious iconography, analysis of the left visual field. And here, of course, is the severed corpus callosum. They did that as an operation on epileptics to stop the epileptic seizure from spreading from one part of the brain to the other. It's very complicated. God showed his trickster aspect in this bilateral crossing of the brain, so the left visual field corresponds to the right occipital cortex. The right visual field corresponds to the left cortex. It gets very complicated in there. But the right hemisphere, especially the right orbital prefrontal cortex, tends towards catastrophic pessimism. Very interesting. The revenge of the right hemisphere. When the left hemisphere is occluded or slowed in functioning and the right is activated, it can lead to depression, paranoia, dark fantasies, poor executive functions, planning, sequencing, and organizing, poor initiative, proactive or constructive approach, poor discernment, lousy problem solving, rage attacks, and explosiveness. So there, have fun. Orthodoxy means literally straight thinking, linear versus circular time. The eschatologies begins with Zoroastrianism and the idea of a grand finale. I'm reviewing a little bit now. A bishop of Alexandria called Irenaeus resolved to hack down the forest of apostasy. The Gnostics and the apocryphal writings. Anybody here read the Gnostic Gospels of Elaine Pagels? I mean, that is wonderful stuff. Thunder, perfect mind. I mean, some of the greatest sayings of Jesus are in that Gnostic Gospels. Lift up a stone and I am there. The paradise of God is spread out upon the earth and men do not see it. All kinds of wonderful things. And Irenaeus resolved in the 3rd century to hack that all down. And Christianity and Islam are evangelical religions, not ethnic religions. Something new in the world that began starting with Zoroastrianism, then through Christianity. Judaism is an ethnic religion. Your mama's Jewish, probably. Christianity gets converts, and so they're evangelicals. You have the idea of missionaries going out and making converts, and you have to have a leap of faith. It's quite a leap sometimes, and vigorous, if not forcible, conversions. It was Tertullian, a Roman intellectual who became a Christian, who said, credo quia absurdum, I believe because it is absurd. And you've heard a man converted against his will is of the same opinion still. Psychology of religious conversion shows something different. Some of the most forcibly converted people become the most fanatical and devout. They must justify their giddy leap into belief. So in 2000, the American Psychological Association published William James's Varieties, not of religious experiences, but of anomalous experiences, which includes standard mystical experiences combined with more recent ones, such as NDEs, or near-death experiences, and out-of-the-body experiences. Do people get religious when they've had a near-death experience? You betcha, and you're looking at one. And my friend John Mack, who passed away a few years ago, who interviewed the people who believed that they had been abducted by aliens. And so the 2002 meeting of the Association of Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback, I got together a group of really distinguished colleagues and presented on the relationship between head injuries and mystical and anomalous experiences. Now, here's a drawing depicting a head injury and what goes on. And you can learn much more about this, those of you who have head injuries in your family, by reading Mary Lee Estes' wonderful book, Conquering Concussion. And these are brain maps. These are lens maps that show bad head injuries here, both on the right side and on the left side. There's something called a contra coup, which is a blow on the opposite side. So if the actual, whatever it was, hit here, there's an effect on the opposite side. I have recently been treating a young woman who tried to commit suicide by hitting herself in the temples with a hammer. And guess what? It affected her. She didn't try the pill route or anything like that, although she did try that actually earlier, and she tried cutting. But she wanted to really end her life, so she thought a hammer might be the best way to Do it. Now, in researching my work on head injury, a colleague told me about Edgar Cayce's beginning of his visionary career. At the age of 4, he pitched off a porch and was impaled through the top of his head on it with a 20-penny nail. And they didn't know what to do about that at the time, so they poured turpentine in the hole and sent him to school. And not within about a year after that, he had his first visits from angels, and he was able to diagnose and heal at a distance. And he was called the sleeping prophet because he had to go into an unconscious state. Remember we talked about Aum? In M, you're in cosmic consciousness, only you're unconscious of it. Cayce evidently was able to use that state of sleep to travel around in his astral body and check things out, and he was pretty amazing.
If you want to follow up on some theories about just what happened to Cayce, you can look up trepanning, if you haven't already. T-R-E-P-A-N-N-I-N-G. It's an ancient practice of opening the top of the skull for visionary reasons, and it's all over the world.
Many places all over the world you find skulls with holes knocked in them.
Look it up in
it's
online.
As if they were creating shamans. They kind of knock a hole in your skull so that you can get into cosmic consciousness or visionary states. Now, my theory is, and I've never heard anybody really talk about this. I mean, James Joyce came the closest in which he said, history is a nightmare from which I am struggling to awaken. But the entire Middle Ages was acted out by people with head injuries. Now, why do I have that idea? Where did I get that outlandish idea? There were 3 crusades and then a 4th one, 3.5 crusades, this was a children's crusade. And boy, were they violent events. Pope Urban preaches the crusades in 1095. Go and take back the Holy Land from those ghastly unbelievers who believe in a God with a different name. And here's the siege of Antioch. Now,
just mention, if you're going to talk about Contra Coup and the inside of a helmet.
Well, a helmet and a suit of armor didn't protect you from these weapons like these maces and war hammers. I mean, my God. And the kings and the knights and the lords and the dukes, everybody who went to war had head injuries, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah. And this was the ruling class.
On the way to the Holy Land, you passed through, there were lands where Jews owned property. And we'll confiscate that on the spot and hang them up and torture them. War hammers, especially when mounted on a pole, by impact alone could damage without penetrating the armor. And in particular, they transmitted an impact even through the thickest helmets and skull to damage the brain against its own skull. Aren't these beautiful? It's such beautiful instruments.
Yeah.
I mean, you could go to war with one of those in your hand and feel invincible. And here's an actual war hammer. And I guess, I don't know what you use the back for, maybe pecking a hole in somebody's armor if you want to get at them. And you'll read the story of King Henry VIII. Now, I've always thought he was one of the greatest monsters in history, right? He bankrupted the entire English nation. He stripped the golden roofs off the churches and all this kind of thing. He beheaded 7 wives? 5 wives? I can't remember how many. 4 of them? What's that?
He divorced a lot of them. He only killed a few.
Killed 2.
Oh, he just killed 2? Okay. I stand corrected.